huge amount of work to do to make sure it's implemented. So therefore, right now, if you look at what's on the table, there are a few optimistic signs, but it's way less than what the science is saying we need to do in Copenhagen, in Paris at the end of the year. But I believe there's a lot of momentum building up as we get there, and maybe our political leaders will do the right thing. But whether they do the right thing or not, we will, and different from Copenhagen, we had the march at the beginning of the 2 weeks. We will start with the march, and on the last day, we will end with the march to send a clear message to our politicians that citizens are going to be engaged. We are not going to trust you. We're not going to actually invest faith in you. We're going to continue to hold your feet to the fire and continue to push, because what is at stake here is our children and their children's future, and that's much too precious for us to leave to politicians alone.
Kumi Naidoo, we want to thank you for being with us. Executive Director of Greenpeace International, who's stepping down at the end of the year. That does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like a copy, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Noguera are engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grant, David Prude, Vesta Vidars. I'm Amy Goodman. Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vibe of Portland's fall fundraising event, October 2nd from 5 to 9 at Tabor Space in Portland. Vibe exists because arts education is missing in today's daily educational system. Vibe connects local teaching artists who are passionate about bringing their love of music and visual arts to the students they work with. At this event, you can learn about where Vibe has been this last year and see where they're headed. There will be food, a silent auction, and entertainment by the Barra Brown Trio. Again, that's the Vibe of Portland's fall fundraising event, October 2nd from 5 to 9 at Tabor Space, 5441 Southeast Belmont in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring a web and new media coordinator. This is a part-time position, 30 hours per week, with a starting salary of $14.62 per hour. Applications are due Friday, September 25th at 5 p.m. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. The full job description and instructions for how to apply are available on our website, www.kboo.fm, under News from the Boo on the right-hand side of the homepage.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, House Majority Speaker John Boehner resigns.
Pope Francis I addresses the UN on economic inequality.
Local Water Alliance proposes initiative to ban corporate water bottling in Hood River.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, September 25th, 2015. I'm Callie Mikhail.
And I'm Liam Delta. Wednesday evening in Hood River, the Local Water Alliance launched the Hood River County Water Protection Measure, a ballot initiative that would ban corporate water bottling facilities in the county. A large crowd filled the Springhouse Cellar Winery to hear speakers watch a video on the proposed Nestle plan and Cascade locks made by local high school students, and listen to live music. KBOO News will have audio from the event next week. In the meantime, another community in the Pacific Northwest is fighting to regain control of their local water resource in the face of yet another multinational corporate takeover. Mount Shasta, a small town on I-5 about 50 miles south of the Oregon border, has been targeted for its water by Otsuka Holdings, a Japanese pharmaceutical corporation which owns the Crystal Geyser Water Company. Crystal Geyser would follow in the steps of Danone and then Coca-Cola, which for 10 years pumped billions of gallons of local water to fill single-use plastic bottles for export around the world. Earlier today, KBOO's Paul Rowland spoke with Vicki Gold of Water Flows Free. She's a Mount Shasta resident who's helping organize an event tomorrow they call Water, Every Drop Sacred, at Mount Shasta City Park.
We had Nestle try to come into McLeod a number of years ago, and I was part of that. The Mount Shasta Bioregional Ecology Center stepped up and allowed some women in McLeod to be umbrellaed under them when they filed a lawsuit. And we fought that for about 6 years. They took over, and we didn't have an active role in that. But later, we knew that because this is a source of water for the whole state of California, and there's very little regulation on source, point source, we knew that we would be under attack again by these corporate profiteers. There's already a large water bottling plant in Weed pumping as much as 1.5 million gallons a day and sending it to Japan. That's owned by Otsuka Pharmaceuticals, which is the same corporation that owns Crystal Geyser Water Company, which is attempting to open here in Mount Shasta, just 8 miles south of the Weed plant.
So Crystal Geyser came in, a couple years ago this got started?
Yes, well, they bought the plant. I believe it was finalized in July of 2013. The grant came through in September of 2013. We found out about it in the newspaper in October. Previously, we had no way of knowing because the notices in the paper only said that there was an EDA grant to cover the construction of the interceptor line. It never once mentioned Crystal Geyser. So when we saw the ribbon-cutting ceremony in the paper, we were shocked. And, of course, we took action immediately, asking questions, advising the City Council and the Board of Supervisors that this was going to have a tsunami of public reaction, and that they should let Crystal Geyser know up front before they spent $20 million retooling the plant so that they would not have damage to their brand and to their pocketbook. We tried to be upfront about it. We told everybody. Apparently they weren't listening or didn't choose to.
How much opposition has there been within the community then?
Tremendous opposition. When we had the initial meeting with Crystal Geyser presenting here in March 24th of 2014, 350 people showed up at the City Council, standing room only. It was professionally videotaped. They made quite a bad presentation. They really didn't answer all of the questions that were asked. And from that time on, we've been studying the issue, sending Freedom of Information Act requests, Public Record Act requests of the various agencies, city, county, EDA. So we have literally reviewed tens of thousands of documents to see exactly how this has happened and why there was so little interest in listening to the public.
Do you see this as a viable economic base for the area, for the community?
Absolutely not. You know, resource extraction never works. When does it ever work? When people come in and take the resources and then leave and it's benefited the community. Having the control of water in the hands of a private corporation is really an idea whose time has passed. It never works. Whenever there has been an effort to allow that to happen in Stockton, in Georgia, it always has led to higher prices, more problems. The city of Weed has a problem right next door because Roseburg Timber Works, Timber Company, controls the water, and they sell it to the city for, I believe, $1 a year in exchange for them managing all of their wastewater. But when the city attempted to regain and reclaim control of the water for the city from the springs that are controlled by Roseburg, Roseburg filed a lawsuit against them. So we're very apprehensive. And by the way, Roseburg supplies the water to Crystal Geyser Roxanne, which is in Weed. And as far as the jobs are concerned, they came in under the EDA grant, and it's there in writing that they would provide 150 jobs. We later discovered that they were planning on closing the Bakersfield plant, the Valencia plant, and the Calistoga plant, and transferring those jobs up here, which would create blight in those communities. That is a violation of any EDA grant. So they apparently were not coming clean on that grant application, and consequently, those 150 jobs really turned out to be, I believe, 12 jobs over a 3-year period. until 2018. So to give up your water and to have no controls over the amount extracted for 12 jobs over 5 years is not a good deal.
Well, thank you so much for that, and good luck tomorrow, and look forward to continuing to build this regional Pacific Northwest Water Alliance, which seems to be happening. So thank you, Vicki Gold, with Water Flows Free, and we'll be talking again.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Okay, bye-bye.
A federal judge in Oregon has ruled that the Oregon Clean Fuels Bill can move forward, despite an attempt by the oil industry to stop the bill from going into effect. Federal Judge Ann Aiken upheld the Oregon's Clean Fuels Bill, which was first passed in 2009, and requires a 10% reduction of carbon emissions in the state's fuel by 2025. The Oregon Environmental Council said that the decision shows that the Oregon way is to reward innovation, protect our clean air and communities, and provide drivers with more choices in how they fuel up. The Clean Fuels program faces opposition by a group backed by the oil and transportation industry. Lawmakers are divided along partisan lines, with Republicans demanding that clean fuels be repealed and Democrats pledging to uphold the clean fuels rules. As a result, by the end of the legislative session in July, a comprehensive transportation funding bill had not been passed, and long-term maintenance of Oregon's roads and bridges hadn't been paid for. According to a survey sponsored by Renew Oregon, 2/3 of Oregon voters support the measure to require a 10% reduction in fossil fuel emissions throughout the state.
Investigation by the Oregonian has found that hundreds of homes in Portland have been torn down without properly removing the asbestos inside due to weak regulatory oversight. Asbestos is considered safe if undisturbed, but airborne asbestos fibers can cause a range of cancers, posing a health risk to the construction workers and the residents of neighboring houses. The lack of state supervision is serious. Oregon's only asbestos inspector position in the region that includes Portland has been left vacant for at least 3 years. It's estimated that over 300 homes with asbestos have been demolished in that time. Starting in 2016, new state legislation prompted by community action will require contractors or owners to look for asbestos before demolishing a house. But there's no system in place for the state to check whether contractors perform such inspections or remove what they find. Portland recently started asking contractors to certify they've removed asbestos, but the city says it has no enforcement authority. Washington has a more effective system with added layers of regulation, which could benefit Oregon if implemented here, according to Jerry Strawn. He's an asbestos inspector with the Southwest Clean Air Agency in Washington.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis from Counterspin. This will be followed by KBOO's weekly feminist collective program, Bread and Roses, at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather in the Portland area is partly cloudy with a high of 69 and a 10% chance of rain. On Sunday, as KBOO members prepare to gather for our annual meeting at noon at the Native American Student Center at PSU, the weather will continue to be sunny and nice with a high of 72 and a 10% chance of rain. Today in history, on September 25, 1957, in Little Rock, Arkansas, federal troops moved in to clear a path for 9 African American students to be allowed to integrate a local high school. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "A riot is the language of the unheard. And what is it America has failed to hear? It has failed to hear that the promises of freedom and justice have not been met. And it has failed to hear that large segments of white society are more concerned about tranquility and the status quo than about justice and humanity."
Republican House Majority Speaker John Boehner announced his resignation from Congress today in a surprise abdication that came only one day after he realized his long-held dream of bringing the Pope to visit Congress, and just a few days before the legislature will run out of funding if lawmakers don't compromise on a budget plan before October 1st. Boehner had struggled to control his increasingly volatile and divided Republican representatives during recent years, and presided over the highly unpopular shutdown of the federal government in 2013, when Republicans refused to pass a budget plan providing funding for the Affordable Care Act. The shutdown carried on for 16 days and cost the U.S. economy an estimated $24 billion. But in the end, the Affordable Care Act remained in place, and the Republican image was severely tarnished. Many of the same conservatives who advocated for that shutdown have been leading the charge towards another budgetary shutdown over the federal funding of Planned Parenthood, a move Boehner has vocally opposed. With his resignation slated for the end of October, it appears likely that the budgetary showdown, or rather the budgetary shutdown over Planned Parenthood funding will not happen, because now Boehner can team up with House Democrats to publicly oppose the shutdown without fear of reprisal from his own caucus, while the more conservative representatives can count his resignation as a temporary victory.
As part of his speaking tour of the U.S., Pope Francis I spoke earlier today at the UN in New York City about predatory lending practices and an economic system that continues to disenfranchise the poor worldwide. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke earlier today with Eric Lecomte, the executive director of Jubilee USA Network, about the Pope's speech.
Sure. My name is Eric Lecomte. I am the executive director of Jubilee USA Network, and we were founded in the 1990s by Pope John Paul II and religious leaders in order to relieve the debt of developing countries around the world. And since that time, we have won over $130 billion in debt relief that by international law we have won has been used to build hospitals and schools throughout the developing world. And today we work on tax, trade, and debt policies to address inequality and end extreme poverty.
How did the Pope characterize financial lending from wealthy countries to poor or undeveloped ones?
Pope Francis's speech today at the United Nations was very powerful in regards to lending. We've accompanied Pope Francis over the last 3 days as he spoke at the White House and spoke at Congress and then today at the United Nations. In his White House and his Congress speech, he was very direct about the need to protect the vulnerable and to address inequality. But today at the United Nations, we saw Pope Francis become very technical and very specific about the actual policies that create poverty and create inequality. We saw today him actually say that we need to change oppressive lending policies that keep countries and people in poverty. He alluded to the International Monetary Fund, to creditors, to vulture funds, which are a type of hedge fund which exploit poor countries. And he went as far as to say that these kinds of entities are a part of usury, and that is unacceptable. Usury is a term which goes back into the history of the Catholic Church, and at one point was actually considered a sin. Usury is lending at high interest rates in order to make a profit. So Pope Francis made very powerful statements today about the need for the United Nations to be the right place to address and to arbitrate the global debt crisis, and he expressed strong concern about the oppressive policies of groups like the International Monetary Fund and also lending groups.
Do you believe that this could be characterized as broader criticism of free market capitalist kind of principles in general, or did he focus primarily upon lending and debt?
It very much so is an assessment of current economic systems. The Pope continues to speak out about what he calls savage capitalism, extreme capitalism, the kind of capitalism that led to the financial crisis, and that he today was talking about specific solutions to address that. This Pope has also been very critical of communism and socialism, but he's also been very specific, as he was to Congress yesterday, when he noted that we need to look at redistribution of wealth to address inequality and take on the issue of poverty. So we see that in this particular Pope, in this particular moment, he is definitely saying that the current economic systems don't necessarily protect workers, don't necessarily protect the poor, or protect all of us. At the same time, the message of this Pope is very good for most of us. It's certainly good for legitimate businesses and legitimate investors. It's certainly good news for the poor. There's really only a small group that that probably feels very threatened by the Pope's message. And this is a small group of hedge funds that are often referred to as vulture funds because their behavior is so savage.
And how did he characterize them? I mean, you're using the term vulture funds, but how powerful and how much influence do these vulture funds have on the international economic system?
Well, these particular vulture funds and extreme actors in the financial system, which Pope Francis has been referencing, are the ones that forced his native country of Argentina into default. They're the same funds that exploited the economic tragedy in Detroit. They're the same ones that took advantage of Greece and the same ones that right now are trying to take advantage of Puerto Rico. These are our funds which their kind of behavior is the kind of behavior that led to the financial crisis of 2008. So he believes this kind of behavior should be addressed, and very clearly, as he has endorsed a global bankruptcy process at the United Nations, he believes these kinds of funds need to be isolated because they're so dangerous. At the same time, the overall message of Pope Francis in all of his speeches in the United States, and certainly today at the United Nations, is that we all must work together to build an economy where no one is left behind.
On a different note, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership kind of still making progress towards being enacted, what effect do you believe the Pope's criticism of current economic practice, what effect do you believe that'll have on the way governments try to influence multinational free market corporations who have gained an amazing amount of power within the past decades?
That's a very important question, and I think this also goes to the heart of what Pope Francis is saying, that economies must serve people. People should not be subservient to economies. When we're talking about things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Jubilee USA is an organization that's working to alleviate poverty. We very much believe there needs to be trade, that in the developing world there needs to be jobs, but that trade must be fair. And I think some of the challenges that we're still seeing in the Trans-Pacific Partnership that we're concerned with, that the Vatican is concerned with, is around some of the actual policies that are a part of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. For example, the interstate dispute settlement arbitration process, ISDS, and we see how that particular process can favor corporations and can favor illegitimate investors and can even favor these vulture funds above people. So there's great concern about how the arbitration process is implemented. I think another issue in regards to the TPP that both the Vatican and Jubilee USA Network are quite concerned with is the availability of vital medicines to the poorest people in the developing world. Currently, we've seen how pharmaceutical companies can price medicines out of the reach of poor people in the developing world. One of the most horrendous examples of this is around a very vital type of medicine to deal with the AIDS crisis that formerly was under $14 per pill, but an investor bought the patent and now sells that pill for over $700 per pill. This is the type of savage behavior that the Pope is talking about. These are the particular aspects of international trade that we need to address so that we could have good trade and fair jobs for people where they need them all over the world.
That was Eric LeCompte with Jubilee USA Network, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
More than 700 people were crushed to death and 900 were injured yesterday as a stampede broke out during a procession in Mina outside the holy city of Mecca. The annual Muslim Hajj pilgrimage in Saudi Arabia often has a high death toll, but this year makes it one of the worst in the modern history of the Hajj. 2 million people make the pilgrimage each year under exhausting heat conditions, and though Saudi officials are well-versed in handling large crowds, it's very easy for the inexperience and confusion of some pilgrims to lead to disaster. According to Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, Saudi Arabia should let the management of the pilgrimage be a joint Muslim issue or allow a Muslim committee to supervise its management. Pope Francis offered his condolences and prayers.
A longtime civil rights advocate and pastor from Washington, D.C., found himself the center of controversy this week after a talk he was scheduled to give was canceled. The talk, called From Ferguson to Palestine, was initially scheduled to take place at a divinity school at Colgate University in Rochester, New York. But the university rescinded their invitation after pressure from the group Christians United for Israel. Someone who claimed affiliation from Christians United for Israel called Reverend Hagler and threatened to kill him if he gave his talk. But instead of standing by their decision to invite the pastor, the university disinvited him. The United Church of Christ and other groups voiced outrage at the school's decision. And local groups came together to provide an alternate venue for Reverend Hagler to speak. For more, KBOO's Jenka Söderberg spoke with Reverend Grayland Hagler.
Could you talk about, first, why you were disinvited to speak at the Divinity School?
Yeah, I don't know what the Divinity School's discussions with anyone really were. I know that I received some death threats and other threatening things, and so the Divinity School claims that that was part of the issue, that they could not provide security, even though we did not request that security be provided. And the next thing I knew, they had basically pulled the invitation. And there's groups in Rochester like Rock for Israel that claims victory in having the Divinity School pull the invitation on me. And we still went to Rochester anyway.
One of the groups that were pushing to have your talk canceled was Christians United for Israel. What can you tell us about that group?
Yeah, Christians United for Israel is basically one of John Hagee's groupings. John Hagee, who has a mega church, a very Christian Zionist mega church in San Antonio, Texas, has Netanyahu in his pulpit to speak very often and believes in supporting Israel, whether it is right or wrong. And so in a sense, his folks are really theologically locked in a place that doesn't sound or feel rational. And so somebody called me and identified themselves as being from Christians United for Israel, and they said that if I come to Rochester, they'll kill me in the name of the Lord, in the name of Christ.
And did the group Christians United for Israel denounce that death threat that you received?
No, we never heard a response from them at all on anything.
This attempt at intimidation and censorship of your talk actually ended up bringing people and groups together there. Could you talk about what ended up being the result?
Sure. There's a scripture that I love that says, Joseph saying, you may have intended it for evil, but God intended it for good. And that's what happened. Because what we saw take place, we had the events were bigger. It was one event, then it became two events. Each of them were big, and people were attuned to what was going on. And it brought together such a diverse group of people. It was just absolutely awesome and amazing to see. We had Jewish Voice for Peace. You had the Nation of Islam, the Fruit of Islam. You had Christians witnessing for Palestine. You had people from the international community, Palestinians, blacks, whites, Asians in the crowd. You had every single just about denomination. Episcopal priest came up to me at the end and said, if you aren't going to speak here, we were going to get our church open for you to speak. Just those types of things were took place as a response to this attempt to try to fought free speech and to try to intimidate.
Well, again, we've been speaking with Reverend Graylin Hagler, who is the pastor of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C. This week, he had been invited to speak at the Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School in Rochester, New York, and upon receiving death threats, was disinvited instead of giving up. Reverend Hagler traveled to Rochester, gave two talks on the issue of From Ferguson to Palestine. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Callie Mikhail, Paul Rowland, Joe Vance. The producer is Ethan Martin. Our engineer is Ian Gadbury. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.